So, I mean, one of the things I wanted to think about in the book is how the language of crisis presumes that the situation of the present is new or exceptional. And we know that the conditions of Black maternal health are actually largely unchanged.
Welcome to Cringe Watchers, a podcast where typically we invite our expert friends to binge watch TV and talk about sex. I'm Layla Darabi.
And I'm Lori Adelman. For this special episode, we got personal about our reproductive lives and asked Jennifer Nash and Catherine Fennelly, aka Layla's mom, why is everyone still so judgy about motherhood? So, Layla, this is a very special episode we have for our Cringe Watchers today. We know it's been a while. Thank you for being patient with us. And we have some very personal connections to today's topic. We are both going through a period of transition pertaining to motherhood and unmotherhood.
Yeah, and there are two sides to the coin today. I am about to have a hysterectomy, and Lori is about to have her first child. So, a lot of news to share with the Cringe Watchers, but for us, an opportunity to dig in and explore in this episode, because as Lori and I have been talking about for a while, we've both been feminists on paper for a while and advocates for reproductive health as a concept for a while, but never has the concept of reproductive health been more present in each of our lives. And it's definitely been a driving connection in our friendship and in our work on Cringe Watchers and the discussions we have on and off the air. But I think I'll kick it off so that we can end with your happy news.
Okay.
So a few months ago, I got tested for the BRCA genetic mutation because my mother, who we'll talk to later in the episode, had ovarian cancer and has luckily had a hysterectomy herself and is cancer-free. And so I got some genetic testing to look at my own risk for ovarian cancer. And it turns out that I have a genetic mutation called BRCA2. The only time I'd ever heard of the BRCA mutation was Angelina Jolie's famous op-ed in the New York Times, where she explained why she had a double mastectomy and a hysterectomy as a mother to reduce her cancer risk. But she had the BRCA1 mutation. I have a less aggressive mutation called BRCA2. And basically what that means is that I am at very increased risk for breast cancer, for ovarian cancer, and for several other cancers. And what that means for me personally is this, first of all, enormous number of doctor's appointments and screenings. And I should lead by saying I don't have cancer. All my screenings have been clear, and I feel very lucky to have this diagnosis in advance of anything happening. But the, I think, emotional and really personal toll of such a weird diagnosis is feeling like a sitting duck. It's someone telling you, you are almost certainly going to get cancer unless you take some preventative actions. And you have to now think about proactively how you're going to prevent that and how you're going to screen for it. And so that has been my life for the past few months. It has been, first of all, alerting cousins on the side of the family. It turns out my mother tested negative, and it actually comes from the Persian side of my family, which is more rare. I should tell our listeners that I thought it was coming from my mother's side because she has Ashkenazi Jewish heritage, and there's extremely elevated risk of having this mutation and of breast cancer in general among Ashkenazi Jews. But it turns out, no, it's from the other side. And one interesting side effect of having something that's so hereditary is I've been able to do a ton of genetic counseling and a lot of oral family history with my father and my mother and talking about all the health issues of everyone, probably things we should have discussed long ago. But the other thing that I've realized, and that I think I also knew on paper from working in reproductive health, is that screening for ovarian cancer is really bad and that we don't have the screening that we have for breast cancer. And so the urgent diagnosis when you have a BRCA diagnosis is that your ovaries essentially are out to get you and they want you to get rid of them as soon as possible. And so you're presented with this menu of options. You can keep, you get rid of just your ovaries and your fallopian tube. You can get rid of your cervix and your uterus and all these different things. And for a number of reasons, I'm about to get a total hysterectomy. I also feel very lucky that I got this diagnosis just before my 45th birthday, which is the age at which they tell you to really ramp up the screening and all the risk kicks in. So I'm still young enough to be very preventative. But also after I had already decided not to have children. And so it's been really stressful, but I can't imagine what a diagnosis like this would have felt like if I were in my 20s, if I didn't have a partner, if I were still thinking about having kids, if it really puts a ticking time bomb, someone telling you that a part of your body could hurt you and that you need to remove it. And so at the risk of TMI, I have found a lot of solace in marching towards a really proactive plan of removing all my lady parts. So I am having an immediate hysterectomy as soon as I could schedule it. I've screened for everything else. And at the end of the year, I will have a double mastectomy, and maybe we'll have to do a follow-up episode because I haven't even begun to tap into the really bizarre world of removing and reconstructing your breasts. I should thank you, Lori. You've been such a good listening ear, especially to my rants about the healthcare system, which I know we share at this time when we're both going through something both personal and medicalized.
Absolutely. No, the rants have been getting me through, and I actually don't say it enough how impressed I am with you and grateful I am to you for sharing this part of your life and your journey, not only with me, but with our listeners, because there is, I think, very little knowledge out there, and especially very little kind of feminist oriented information and content about this. What you said is exactly right. When you shared this with me, my mind went to Angelina Jolie, and that's it. And you know, good for her that she lifted her voice up, but I think we can all agree many more experiences are important to share. So I really respect and appreciate you for how you're approaching this and how much you're sharing. And you're right. We have been sort of on this dual path together in a way. And I think there's something very feminist about how we've been supporting each other. And I know, you know, you said it, you sort of feel like a sitting duck. I can relate to that. On my pregnancy journey, I felt, you know, a lot of waiting. We've been on a multi-year journey to get pregnant. Myself and my partner, that has also included a miscarriage and then trying to get pregnant again. And then once you do get pregnant, there's this thing that I don't think people talk about enough, which is a sort of countdown to childbirth that can feel very dreadful in the sense that, you know, one of the only things anyone can agree about motherhood is that childbirth is one of the most painful experiences of your lifetime, potentially. So I really feel grateful to have been able to be sharing with you and now with our audience throughout this time period what I'm going through and what it feels like to, you know, if you're young at 45, I'm certainly old at 37 for my motherhood journey. So I'm officially a geriatric pregnancy. And apparently between that and my race, I am considered very risky. So I've been poked and prodded all over town. They draw blood almost every time I go into the OBGYN. And it's essentially, it feels like for them, a treasure hunt just to figure out what might be wrong at any given time. And they really do often assume the worst, I think, for the right reasons. And so that's been really interesting. This is definitely my most hardcore experience with the capital H healthcare system, as well, as you put it. And so naturally, because we are the cringe watchers, we've been thinking and theorizing about this experience even as we're going through it. And so, you know, today, the episode that we are bringing you all is on this theme, and that includes our binges and cringes, but we also want you to know this will be our last episode until the spring while we take medical and family leave. So please be patient with us, and we're looking forward to seeing you back in the spring. So with that being said, Layla, are you binging or cringing this week?
I am binging all kinds of content, but I think one of the things that I've been reading that is most relevant to our topic today and that I think cringe watchers would appreciate is a special series that The Guardian has been running on Black women and infertility, which is edited by Lauren L. Williams, superstar editor at The Guardian. I learned about this event through a friend of the show, Julie Meshack. Shout out Julie, who works at The Guardian and who knows that I care about these issues. And I've been looking through the series, which I think kicked off with a piece on Black women and IVF. I don't have to get into all the different content. People should check it out. The tagline or the promotional piece that I've seen running on the Guardian website is a common refrain I've heard from Black women over the years is, quote, "I wish more people had talked about this. And so we are." And I think the series that they're running is very similar to our episode today, which are reproductive health issues that people don't talk about enough. And if you like that series, you should go back and listen to our past episode on IVF, which was all about Black women and IVF, and one of the more interesting episodes I like to go back and listen to, where we talk to a provider. Lori, are you binging or cringing?
You just gave us so much to binge, so I'm loving that, and I can't wait to read through the whole series. So I will do a more upsetting piece of content, and I will throw my cringe out this week to foster parents who don't want to give back the baby to their biological parents, even when it would be best for everyone involved. So The New Yorker really recently ran a piece by Eli Hager on this topic. It's very harrowing. I highly recommend it. But the reason that I was sort of tuned into this and read it immediately when I saw it was because I recently heard the reproductive justice Shiro icon mainstay Dorothy Roberts, who of course is famous for her classic book, Killing the Black Body, speak about the foster care system, which she calls the foster industrial complex. And this is a really interesting argument that she puts out. I think everybody should do more research into it. And what she has stated is that, you know, foster care even, she considers a term of propaganda, given the fact that child welfare in this country, how it operates, is one of a family policing system that does target poor and Black people, and in many cases is explicitly designed to provide rich and or white families with a domestic supply of infants. And that's around quotes, because you'll see in her writing that actually is a real quote that has shown up, that the state has endorsed. And so this is not a knock on like foster parents writ large. There, I think, are a lot of interesting feminist perspectives from within the foster care system. I especially want to shout out Koa Beck, who has written really interestingly about becoming a foster parent as a Black, multiracial, queer feminist person. But it's about the system writ large, and specifically how very recently in many states, adoption lawyers have begun pushing a new legal strategy that essentially forces biological parents to compete for custody of their children with foster parents who tend to be richer and lawyered up and who are seeking to use the foster care system as sort of a backdoor to adoption. So all of these systems are very, very broken, which I am cringing this week. But I think it's a really important part of the overall reproductive health and justice landscape to understand the foster care system. And it often doesn't get sort of talked about in the same breath. So I really encourage folks to think about that and understand that. And I also, you know, I think there's so much writing all the time about, you know, motherhood and reproductive health, but I just want to make sure that this piece of it doesn't get lost, because it's especially relevant for sort of poor and Black folk. And I mean, speaking of writing all the time about reproductive health, I'd really like to toot our horn here, Layla, because I think for our interview today, we got some of the best and most interesting writers out there on the topics that we wanted to get into. So maybe we should tell our listeners a little bit about the two fabulous women that we interviewed today.
Yes, I'm really excited about the powerhouse duo we are talking to today. We're first going to speak to Dr. Jennifer C. Nash, who is the Jean Fox O'Barr Professor of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies at Duke, and who has written three books, all of which I've been introduced to by you, Lori, a longtime evangelist of her incredible work. She has written a book called The Black Body in Ecstasy on Race and Pornography, a book called Black Feminism Reimagined. And then the book we discussed in more depth with her is called Birthing Black Mothers. And I think from our discussion here today, you can understand why we zoomed in on that.
That's right. And she actually has a fourth book coming out, which I'm sure will do nothing but further solidify how much of a fangirl I am. It's called How We Write Now, Living with Black Feminist Theory. Sounds right up my alley. Yes, please. Put it right into my veins. I just want to say one of the reasons I really am such a fan of Dr. Nash's writing is because she is what I would call a gentle contrarian. And I really wish that there were sort of more of these folks in public life. I think they're very good, especially for movements like reproductive health movement. And what that means to me is that she often seems to bring an observation or critique that is coming from a place of calling in, to borrow a phrase from Loretta Ross, or essentially critiquing from the left or from within a movement. And I just feel like that's a really healthy thing to do. For me, it's very intellectually interesting. It's very emotionally, like, helpful and cathartic to hear a smart person sort of theorize around something that I've also noticed or wanted to express, but been maybe scared to or not sure how to. So from that place, we really got into it with Dr. Nash in our interview. We talked about Black maternal mortality. We talked about Black doulas. We talked about Black Lives Matter and sort of the grieving mothers of Black Lives Matter as a political force and so much more. Of course, we got into the state of feminism. So there's really so much there. We're so excited about this interview. And then, of course, we have the double whammy. So after you hear from Dr. Nash, you will hear a little bit from another wonderful scholar named Dr. Catherine Fennelly, who also happens to be Layla's mother.
I was very excited that we were able to host my mother, Catherine Fennelly, who goes by Kathy. She is a professor of public policy. She was formerly a professor of public health. We get into that and her career transition a little bit when we talk to her. She is currently a professor emerita at the Hubert Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota, but she's also written a book called Family Declassified, Uncovering My Grandfather's Journey from Spy to Children's Book Author, where she digs into our own family history, centering her grandfather, but as we'll talk about, getting into some of the mothers in our past as well. My mom is an incredible figure who went to high school in Iran, college in Spain, was the first female field officer for CARE International and lived in Ecuador, was a founding researcher at the very first Department of Population and Family Health at Columbia, and now is our first mom on the show.
So cool. Love it. It was amazing to talk to her, and we can't wait for you all to hear both interviews. So without further ado, here are Jennifer Nash and Catherine Fennelly. Welcome to Cringe Watchers, Dr. Jennifer Nash.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're so excited for this conversation. As you know, this is our motherhood slash unmotherhood episode, and you have literally written the book that we feel sort of will best take us through a number of topics and help us cover all the ground. So we are going to jump right in today. We have a lot we want to talk to you about. And birthing Black mothers meant so much to me. Even before I was pregnant, it really connected with me on so many levels. You explore Black Lives Matter. You explore Black maternal mortality, breastfeeding. You touch on sort of the celebrity conversations around motherhood, from Serena Williams to Michelle Obama to Beyonce. So it's a complex and nuanced journey. That's just you. But what we really just wanted to start with is where you started, which is with the story of Malaysia Goodson, who died protecting her one-year-old while falling down a set of stairs in the New York City subway. And I'm sorry to start on such a grim note, but I really think her story represents so much of what you go on to break down in the book. And I wonder if you can just share a little bit why you chose to open the book with this story as opposed to write like the Serena story that maybe is more out there in the media that everybody is more familiar with.
Yeah, thanks for that. I was really moved, and I was moved by her story. I was drawn to her story. And I think some of the reason why it spoke to me so much as someone who grew up in the New York area was thinking about the ways that Black mothers are largely invisible in public life until tragedy happens. And so I was so struck by thinking about the number of people who walked past Malaysia Goodson as she struggled. As anyone who's used the New York City subway knows, it's very hard to find an elevator. And when there are elevators, they often don't work. And so thinking about the number of people who walked past her as she struggled to carry a stroller, a child, shopping bags down the stairs. And then when she dies at the bottom of the stairs, in such a, holding her child in such a way that her child's life is spared, she becomes a story of heroism. And I was really interested in what makes that happen, what made her invisible and then made her hyper-visible in death, and what it would mean for us to actually see Black women, Black mothers, as they move through their daily lives, rather than just or only seeing them as tragic figures. So, and I really became interested in the way that her story then became mobilized in so many different political ways, right? So you had groups who talked about her, importantly, around issues of accessibility and public transportation. That is an important issue, right? But I was really interested in her and how her particular life story became, her as a human became lost, invisible in daily life. And so I think for me, she was a point of entry into the book because I wanted to think about why in American public life, we only see Black mothers when they're proximate to death, and why Black mothers only become visible when we see them dead or dying. And so in some ways, her story was a way into thinking through those questions.
Wow. Yeah, I think that there's so much there, and you know, we're not symbols, we are people. And, you know, I think for me, it's such a counter narrative, including from a class perspective, to the idea of like, oh, well, if a hyper-visible celebrity like Serena Williams can't get care, what hope do the rest of us have around being a Black mother? And I think we often sort of will hear about people who are already hyper-visible and stories we can already relate to, but it's harder to start from a place of focusing on the person who might not have been hyper-visible to begin with. So really appreciated that. And I think let's go on. I want to dig more into some of the arguments you make in birthing Black mothers.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the BLM mamas that you write about and the media attention around the mothers of victims of police brutality becoming politically engaged. And it's such an interesting frame. Your book is, I think, about so much more than motherhood, but uses motherhood as a frame. Why enter that BLM conversation through the frame of moms?
Yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to think through a few things. I started writing the book in a moment where I think there was a really important Black feminist critique of Black Lives Matter as focusing on Black boys and men, right? And so I'm thinking of like someone like Kimberly Crenshaw, I always say her name, really wanting to spotlight the ways that Black women, Black girls, Black femmes also die at the hands of the state. And I think that's a really important intervention that we need to keep talking about. And also, I was really interested in the ways that I saw Black women through the figures of Black mothers actually becoming really central to the Black Lives Matter moment. To think about that word that Lori, you used a minute ago, symbols, right? To think about how Black mothers, particularly the mothers of the movement, became these really important political symbols in a Black Lives Matter moment. So I remember watching the mothers of the movement stand on stage with Hillary Clinton at the Democratic National Convention. And it's not an uncomplicated moment. Some of the mothers didn't support her in the same ways that other mothers supported her, but they all came to the DNC to confer their kind of moral vision and political weight on Hillary Clinton. And that to me was really interesting. Like, what did they stand for, right? Like, what was the politics of being a Black mother who had lost a child at the hands of the state? So I wanted to think about that. And I wanted to think about the complexities of what it means when Black mothers enter political life as synonyms for Black grief. And so I was also really struck, I don't remember if it made into the book or a different version of this work, but Samira Rice, Tamir Rice's mother, gave a really interesting interview to New York Magazine that she did with Imani Perry, where she basically, I think the title of the article was Stop Hustling Black Death. And she basically said, all of these people talk about my son. Nobody's asking me how I feel about my son. My son has become this symbol, this metaphor. And she's directing this critique not just at the right and the ways that they demonized her son and demonized Black children who die all the time, but she was also talking to us on the left who continue to use her son's name for all sorts of political ends. And she, part of what she wanted to say was like, my grief has become a commodity and it's not even my own anymore, right? Like she's like, nobody's asking me about my own feelings of grief and loss or what my son meant to me. They just use his name. And so I wanted to think about that as well, right? When Black maternal pain is a political object that circulates in the world and that can confer kind of political bona fides on particularly left politicians, there are actual material grieving Black people whose grief gets yes. lost in this kind of political economy.
It's so fascinating. And this might be slightly outside of the realm of today's conversation, but it's so interesting that this is all happening against a backdrop of like a rise in popularity in the discourse around Afro-pessimism and sort of equating Blackness to death in symbol and in reality, and really digging into the lineage of how slavery is still with us today and what that means for like our personhood and humanity, and seeing even like Twitter warriors take up that cause and really put front and center the idea of Black death as like a revolutionary politic is, I think, is really an interesting parallel to all of what was going on. But, you know, I think speaking of the material conditions of Black death, let's talk about maternal health outcomes a bit. Layla and I, we both come from or are at least tangentially related to a public health world. So we are in a world where people just sort of love to cite these statistics. Okay. Sometimes I'm like shocked by how easily the statistics of Black female death just roll off the tongue of like public health professionals. It's really, really common now. So we know there are racial disparities in maternal mortality. Okay, this is now known. You also write about the ways in which these sort of poor maternal health outcomes for Black women have been framed by the media, by politicians, by Black reproductive justice advocates as a crisis, often in the name of feminism. And this was, I think, one of the most fascinating parts of the book for me, because you sort of juxtapose that to the uncomfortable truth that actual health outcomes for Black women have remained stubbornly poor, even when accounting for income and education levels in many cases. So you cite some CDC data, which finds that the racial disparity in maternal mortality has not changed, might even have worsened. So it makes me think about like a Naomi Klein shock doctrine. Okay, you cite the late Lauren Berlant's work on crisis as a genre that obscures the ordinariness of poor conditions, right? So we're talking about, on the one hand, a huge crisis that everyone's talking about. On the other hand, no progress whatsoever. What is up with that? Is framing Black maternal health outcomes as a crisis obscuring the real work that needs to be done, right? So what's happening there?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I mean, I think one of the things that really interests me, in addition to what you said about how the rehearsal of these statistics has become so commonplace, is also that I really think in the last 5 years, there's been a growth of an expert class in Black maternal health, right? So you have, I mean, and I run into these folks all the time, and I respect their work deeply, like folks who are getting certificates and trainings in Black maternal health, who are thinking in all sorts of ways about disparity. And I'm fascinated by the rise of this expert class of experts alongside the persistence of racial disparity, and the fact that the rise in the class of experts has actually done very little to move the needle around Black maternal health. So, I mean, one of the things I wanted to think about in the book is how the language of crisis presumes that the situation of the present is new or exceptional. And we know that the conditions of Black maternal health are actually largely unchanged. And I think Linda Villarosa's article that sort of kicked off much of the journalistic conversation about Black maternal health really wants to make the point that if you start in 1850 and you look to the present, you see very little changes in Black maternal health outcomes. So actually what we're thinking about as crisis is just the conditions of the ordinary. And framing it as crisis might be part of the problem. I think my own other interest in the crisis framing, and I started writing this book in the weeks after my daughter was born, was what the crisis frame does to Black laboring women and Black maternal subjects, which is that it seemingly benign ways suggests that we need help or uplift, and suggests that we are subjects who need to be told what to do by the biopolitical state. And so the first chapter I wrote was the chapter about breastfeeding, because I did not want to breastfeed, and made that abundantly clear, and was met with fierce resistance by people who were working in the name of feminism, right? Like this was resistance I got from pediatricians, from midwives, from doulas, who couldn't believe that I was refusing the health benefits of I'm going to put all that in quotes, refusing health benefits of breastfeeding. And they were doing this in the name of what they had been educated in, which is like, oh my goodness, Black women don't have access to breastfeeding in the same way that white women do. And this is a really important health disparity that we need to address. So let me help you and support you and offer you information and encourage you. And I kept saying, I don't need encouragement or information. Like, this is a decision that I've made. And so I think it's really interesting how the crisis framing leads to this idea that Black women need support, encouragement, and help. And I think part of what's so interesting to me about that is that I think for so many of us, and by us, I mean Black women, that feels good because it feels better than how we've been treated before, right? Which is as subjects worthy of condemnation and scorn and critique, right? So all the ways that Black mothers have long been thought of as sort of as responsible for the downfall of the state, as irresponsible. It feels much better to be told, like, I want to help you and encourage you and support you, as opposed to like, you're a bad mother and you're responsible for, you know, the downfall of society. But I actually think similar logics are underpinning all of these things, right? That Black women don't have autonomy, that we lack agency, that we can't make decisions about how to organize our reproductive lives. So I really wanted to think critically about how a really important kind of reproductive justice project, right, which has been spotlighting the very disparities that you're talking about, can lead to some really tricky everyday interactions for Black maternal subjects.
I want to ask you how doulas fit into all of this, because you talk about how doulas have been framed as a fix for Black mothers. And I think there are a couple nuances to that oversimplification. There are tensions with the formal healthcare system. And so I guess the question is, what is the role the doulas for Black mothers are playing right now? And also, do you think doulas are making a dent in these disparities and the statistics that people so like to rattle off?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So, I mean, to the second question first, I think the difference that doulas can make is the difference that care makes in the space of the hospital, right? And when I say the space of the hospital, I really want to think about that capaciously, because I think hospital logics exceed the space of the hospital. So I think there's ways at the birthing center, which is presumably a feminist space, really often feels like the hospital. And so I think what doulas aspire to do in the best of worlds is to bring care into that space and to change the timelines of the hospital. So birthing people will often talk about how everything feels in a rush in a hospital. You're on a certain time schedule, and when your body doesn't comply with those temporal logics, suddenly you find yourself being faced with all sorts of interventions. So, you know, you're not progressing. We really need to induce, right? And I think right. One of the things that doulas say is bodies will birth on their own timeline, and why do we have to rush? And I think that is a really important intervention, given that the kind of temporal frameworks that undergird the hospital are really about capitalism and profit, not about bodies or health. I think doulas are such complicated and interesting figures. I interviewed a whole bunch of doulas in Chicago. And in the years since I interviewed doulas, I think they've gotten even more attention as the figures that are supposed to save Black women. I think among my interlocutors, even when I was conducting my interviews, there was so much ambivalence about the attention that they were receiving. I think in part because many of my interlocutors felt that if the state treats them as these figures who are supposed to save Black women, will they then be indebted to the state? In other words, one of the political moves of the last 5 years has been that we should increase insurance coverage of doulas, that Medicaid should cover doulas. And a number of doulas said, I don't want to work for the state. I don't want to work for Blue Cross Blue Shield. A number of my interlocutors actually held political views that were completely opposed to the logics of the state. So I remember one of my interlocutors who said, I tell everyone who is my client, you don't need prenatal care. Everything your body needs, your body can do for yourself. And she said, I tell all of my clients, you should birth at home. And she was saying that in Illinois, where home birthing is de facto illegal, right? And she was like, if I am to get reimbursed by the state, I cannot say those things, right? And so it would entirely change her orientation toward the work that she was doing. And really, I think, introduce these complicated questions of who is the client. And I think for my interlocutors, the powerful thing about the work that they do is that they see themselves as entirely in service of the birthing person, right? And so when you introduce insurance and state regulation, it becomes messy. I also think, as someone who went into this project thinking that I would have certain interests and actually found I became really interested in questions of standardization and credentialization, the world of doulas is sort of like, it's a delightfully and confusingly lawless world. Anyone can be a doula. You can be trained. You don't have to be trained. You can be certified. You don't have to be certified. And I think to people who are on the outside, which is like a pregnant person who wants to find a doula, one doesn't often think like, oh, I should ask what are your credentials? What is your license? Did you do dona or did you do pro doula? Or right? You just think like, I really want someone with whom I connect and who gets
it's me. All vibes.
It's all vibes, yeah. Right? And one of the things that really surprised me was some of my interlocutors said things like, you know, I did 20 hours of training and none of it was about birth. And I thought, oh, goodness, that worries me, right? And for many of my interlocutors, they felt like their work was really about connection and spirituality and welcoming life into the world. And I say none of that as critique, but I think many clients think of doulas as people who have expertise in birth. So all to say, I think it's messy. And then the last piece is the state, broad term. I mean, even Joe Biden during Black Birthing Week said something like, we need to build our Black birth workforce, which is an interesting term. I think there is this continued sense that Black birth workers are going to do this as a labor of love, that they're going to be underpaid or unpaid, and that that's fine. So like Baltimore in 2018 started a citywide effort to recruit Black women to work as doulas. And they said that Black women would be doing this as a community service. It would be unpaid work. Anyone who's talked to a doula knows it's incredibly demanding to be on call all the time, especially when you have your own family, right? You're juggling multiple births, multiple clients, multiple schedules, the unevenness of getting paid when you have two clients 1 month and five the next month. It's not a tenable way to live. And in fact, most of the people with whom I talked were doing doula work and then three or four other jobs to make ends meet. So the idea that Black women should labor in the service of Black life, which we're all saying is essential work and should do it for free, seems completely illogical to me.
That is mind-blowing.
I think the bureaucracy is a really interesting question because I like your term delightfully lawless. It's so positive, but I do as someone who's been working in global health for many years, I've worked with a lot of traditional midwives, and I know like in Guatemala, for example, there's a big movement there are a lot of feminist NGOs working to create certificates for traditional midwives and to validate women's desire to give birth standing up or squatting, even in a healthcare facility. And some of the rationale behind that is, if I have this certificate, the hospital has to take my opinion slightly more seriously. And I want to make a distinction. I know doulas and midwives are different, but I think a traditional midwife and a doula, it's a grayer distinction. And so it's interesting to hear delightfully lawless in contrast with the, how do we get respect? Because it's so hard to chip away at this Western, there is one way to deliver, and it is designed to slow birth down. And and traditional women saying, why are you making me labor for over 24 hours when for centuries we've understood that if we squat, it speeds it up and then I have a baby.
Yeah. And I have a direct example of that. You know, I'm still pregnant, so I haven't crossed the breastfeeding threshold yet that you did, but have had very similar experiences when it comes to being told that I need a doula, why I need a doula. I've had women burst into tears when they heard that I didn't yet have a doula because literally I might die. That's the message that's coming to me. I'm sitting here pregnant AF, right? And so, and that again, all in the name of feminism, like telling me I'm going to die. Like, that's not what you want to be hearing. I have since doulaed up, and it is such a fascinating, oh my goodness, this is such a fascinating process. First of all, shout out to intersectionality. I doulaed up under insurance coverage add-on that came about through queer organizing to get fertility coverage for queer couples through my job. So they also have a sort of loophole to cover doulas, which I think is like a growing area. And I think it's really interesting that as we need to like add on coverage for more kinds of pregnant people and folks who want to get pregnant, doulas are sort of on the rise there as well. And there's, I'm sure, a lot of behind the scenes politics there. Now that I've doulaed up, it's been very uncomfortable navigating the doula doctor relationship. Like, half of what the doula does is give me like scripts to like explain to my doctor and sort of ingratiate my doctor for future demands that I might make that they like not give Pitocin or whatever. I mean, it's really been fascinating. I understand why you wanted to write about it. I think more needs to be written about it. I also don't see how this is sustainable long term, especially in the name of like helping and supporting the pregnant person, because it's been pretty stressful to navigate. I have to say, it's not like they're not accounting for each other. They're like two different weights that I'm needing to balance at a time when, you know, I don't particularly need another thing on my plate. That's been my experience.
I mean, it's two different paradigms of thinking about reproductive care. And, you know, going back to something that you said, Layla, like one of the things that was so interesting to me when I started interviewing doulas was I was trying to think about the space of the delivery room and the ways that bodies move around each other and come into conflict in that space. And so I would ask doulas, like, can you tell me about conflicts in the room? And I expected to hear about conflicts between doulas and OBs. And I actually almost entirely heard about conflicts between doulas and midwives and doulas and nurses. And that was really interesting to me because many of my doula interlocutors felt that midwives, who were like kind of the linchpin of the feminist reproductive health movement of the 1970s, had become institutionalized and essentially had become OB adjacent, right? And so in Illinois, where you have kind of certified nurse midwives who are embraced by the hospital, right? A number of doulas said, well, midwives just behave like doctors do, and they don't like having us in the room. And so I remember one of my interlocutors told me, she was a young Black woman, told me a story about going to accompany her client to deliver in a big research hospital in Chicago and having a midwife come up to her and say, you know, this is a hospital, none of your incense, none of your woo-woo, none of your crystals. And the doula was like, whoa, I know how to comport myself in a hospital. But it was really interesting to hear that was coming from a midwife. And so I would often ask them, well, what about the OBs? And their response was so great. They were like, we don't even see them. They come in for 2 seconds. Is the labor progressing? Oh, it's not progressing. And then they leave. And so that was also really interesting to hear. So I think, you know, to your point, Lori, like there are, I think part of what makes navigating having an OB and having a doula so challenging for the birthing person is that they have two different logics about birth, about reproductive care, about timelines. I remember, you know, as a pregnant person, my doula saying to me, when we go into the hospital, one of the things that's going to happen is the doctor's going to come in and ask you how you're doing. And we're all going to be like, everything is fine here. Because if you suggest to them that something is not fine, they're going to think of you as a problematic patient. And so I felt, you know, some, I think this echoes some of what you were saying, like I was being coached as to how to move through the space of the hospital strategically so that I would come out alive and my baby would come out alive. This goes to the last thing you were saying, Lori. I mean, there was an article in the Boston Globe a couple of years ago that I remember moved me to tears. And it was about a group of Black mothers who were meeting at this conference called the Mom Friends. And one of the things that they were trying to talk about was, as pregnant Black women, all they were hearing about is how they were going to die and how their children were going to die. And this period of being pregnant, which was, they imagined, supposed to be joyful and exciting, was filled with dread. And they wanted to reclaim some of the spirit of excitement and pleasure that was supposed to be part of pregnancy that they felt had been stolen from them. And this was the really important point, I think. It was like, in the name of reproductive justice, right? That they felt like, you know, I remember one woman said in the article, oh, I go to doctor's visits, you know, with my articles, with, you know, statistics highlighted, on guard. And so it's never fun, right? And she's like, I just want that moment where I look at the ultrasound picture and I feel excited, but I don't have that anymore. And that struck me as a real tragedy that's emerged from the moment that we're in.
Absolutely. I've totally experienced that personally. I understand why it would be happening structurally. And I think it's also impacting care. So I've been explicitly told that, oh, you know, as a 37-year-old pregnant person, you're sort of on the edge of risk in certain categories, but what pushes you over the top is your race. I've been told that, and therefore we're going to prescribe X, or therefore, and it's very interesting because, first of all, you know, they're not similarly accounting for other aspects of identity that probably have as much to do with, you know, my health outcomes, such as class, but also it's just a really strange thing to say to a patient. I feel like, how did we get here where they're like, you know, because you're Black, I think you really need to take this extra baby aspirin and make sure you don't develop preeclampsia. I'm not really sure what to do with that information.
And I also think, I mean, I think one of the curious things about pregnancy is that it's not inherently a time of unwellness, right?
Right.
And right. Which I think is actually another one of the critical interventions of feminism in the 1970s was like, hey, pregnant people often go to hospitals. We usually go to hospitals because we're ill, but pregnant people are not inherently ill, right? They're going through a bodily process that is a natural process. They might require medical support, but it's not a time of unwellness. But I think the discourse that you're describing, Lori, of like, you have to be on guard, actually has this strange way of like re-inscribing Black mothers as unwell, right? Or that the structural conditions subject Black mothers to a kind of racial violence that is manifested as physical unwellness. And so it's really interesting to think about how that dance happens, right? Like, and I see this conversation also happening around, you know, should pregnant people give birth in hospitals or not, right?
And I think that's a discourse that I think extends to contraception and all kinds of reproductive health. I know, Laurie and I have been part of lots of language conversations. Like, shouldn't we call people taking monthly contraception clients and not patients? Because it's we're not sick, and so much of reproductive health, so much of what women do to maintain our bodies has been sort of an initial wave to encourage people to come and deliver in hospitals because it was so risky back in the day to deliver otherwise, or because childbirth was such a leading cause of death of women and still is in many parts of the world. So I understand where this first wave of bring everybody to the hospital comes from. But I really appreciate that framing you just shared around like reclaiming the joy, because the idea isn't to sterilize experience. And if you bring Black women into the hospital, you're also dragging them into the racist structure of all of society. And so it's not an equal barrier to death.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I started writing the book pre-COVID and then COVID happened. And I think COVID sort of rewrote the cultural understanding of home birth. And so home birth went from this thing of like, yeah, you could do that, but it's not a good idea, right? To like, oh no, you should do that because birthing in a hospital is actually incredibly risky. There was that period in March in certain states where you couldn't bring a birthing partner with you, you would have to birth alone. And so you suddenly had the New York Times featuring, you know, heterosexual white couples who've made the decision to birth in their bathtubs. And that was considered risk mitigating, right? And you had hospitals opening birthing centers that were detached from the main hospital to signal birth is a different thing, right? It's not illness. You can do it in a different venue. It's medical adjacent, but it's not a time of unwellness. And so I think this question of like the where of birth remains a really thorny one for feminists, right? Yeah. Because I'll often talk about my work and people will say, well, do you think Black women should just birth at home? And I'm like, that's not really my jam. Like, one of the things that I try to say again and again, and I say this, I was teaching a class on motherhood this past semester, is like, people die giving birth, end sentence. Like, they die. Like, and it was a feminist intervention to bring women to the hospital because the idea was women are dying at home. And if we standardize birth, if we standardize and medicalize birth, it will be safer. And people are dying in the hospital, right? There's like, risk is part of birth. And that doesn't necessarily mean to me that it should be an entirely medicalized process, but I think it's important to talk about that, right? And I think as someone who's written a book on birth, one of the things that's really struck me is people like to tell me their stories about birth. And it's yeah. Interesting to hear, and this goes, you know, to you, Lori, with being doula'd up, my new favorite phrase, is that you know, when you talk to a doula, you spend so much time being like, how do you want your birth to go? What do you want to have happen? Do you want to be standing? Do you want to be sitting? Do you want to be listening to Sade? Do you want the lights up high? Do you want the lights up? And then every doula will tell you that every birth is chaos. It never goes how you expect it to go, right? And so you've made all of these plans and I think you actually have thought, oh, this might go according to plan. And it never does, right? And so I'm really interested in like what it might mean for feminists to develop a way of thinking about birth that's like, this is not going to go down the way you expect at all. Let's just start from that proposition.
I love that. It makes me want to shout out. There was a piece in The Nation by Moira Donegan. I don't know if you saw it. It's about the anti-feminist politics of the natural birth movement and how we have come full circle where we're fully shaming women for like saying, hey, I need a painkiller. I need an epidural during my pregnancy, or this isn't going as planned. And therefore, like, I'm not as much of a woman as I thought I was because I couldn't like do this all on my own in some way. And like some of the very anti-feminist messaging that is coming out of that I think, originally very well conceived and feminist urge. So super interesting. Dr. Nush, we want to make sure we get to some of the other parts of your book because there's so much here. So I'm going to take us forward a little bit to possibly my favorite chapter of your book, which was Writing Black Motherhood. I cannot let you go without just talking about this a little bit. And you essentially conducted like a literature review and sort of found a difference in genres of black and white motherhood, sort of memoir or writings. And I just think there was so much there. It was so fascinating. And I'm curious if you can share with our audience a little bit about your findings about these genres of white motherhood and how they're typically characterized versus black motherhood and how this might reflect some of the broader stereotypes and tropes going on in our society.
Yeah. So first, there's this huge booming genre of the motherhood memoir, which is in and of itself interesting. And I think each one promises to shatter the silence and tell the truth of motherhood, right? Which is that much of the early years of caring for life are actually quite tedious, and that mothers often feel really ambivalent about the loss of identity that seems, for some, is part of the early incredibly demanding years of life. And so, you know, I really wanted to think about that as how the motherhood memoir gets described, right? And I think the primary affect that gets attached to that is ambivalence, right? And so there's this kind of loss of identity, loss of pleasure, sense of life being tedious. So I wanted to think about that alongside a number of Black women writers who I thought were writing motherhood in really different ways. You know, it's funny, I'm going back to ambivalence. I'm ambivalent about many of the ways that they're writing about motherhood, but I'm curious about it. So I'm thinking about someone like Danny McLean, who also wrote for The Nation, who wrote a memoir called We Live for the We. And her book is a celebration of the labor of Black mothering. She talks, it's a kind of Black Lives Matter mothering memoir, but she talks about the real intentional work of creating a life for her daughter, being intentional about what media her daughter consumes, what her daughter eats, who comes into her daughter's space, being intentional about shielding her from discussions of Black death, like really kind of creating this kind of cocoon. Like I was thinking of someone like Bell Hooks, who ages ago wrote about how Black women cultivate home place as this kind of sanctuary from the violence of the outside world. I'm also thinking about someone like Rebecca Walker, who is a really complicated figure. She has her own complicated relationship with her mother, Alice Walker, also a complicated figure. So there's all sorts of dynamics there that are messy. But Rebecca Walker also writes this memoir that's about how deeply she wants to mother, about how important it is to her identity. And I think, you know, it's in some ways a response to her mother, Alice Walker, who wrote quite a bit about how when she started mothering, she lost some of her creative energy. And so I think Rebecca wanted to respond to that. So I was really interested in how you have kind of Black mothers challenging the idea that these early years of life are just about boredom and tedium and losing oneself, and really kind of thinking about those early years as political, as a site of pleasure, as a site of resistance, as a moment of kind of turning inward to the home and thinking about how to make home, how to make safety. As I said, like I have all sorts of questions about this. I'm curious about it. I'm also really interested in what kind of space we make for Black women to talk about rage and boredom and anger and refusal. I think there's a huge and really interesting archive of Black mothers who have been like, I don't like this. This isn't interesting to me. And there has been very little cultural space, I think, for Black women to name that, even less than there has been for white women to name that. And so I'm really interested in that. I'm thinking of my colleague Sherry Randolph at Georgia State, who's doing some really interesting work about Camille Billups and Black women who've given up their children and how we can't conceive of that, right? So anyway, I think there's been this moment where Black maternal memoir writers are carving out another way to think about the doing of motherhood and its meanings.
We don't, I know we've been talking mostly about motherhood and your book on Black motherhood, but I also want to make sure that cringe watchers who are, we know to be bookworms, also check out Black Feminism Reimagined. And so before we jump to our final question, can you, in a word, give us a little maybe soundbite of what is the state of Black feminism, in your opinion? No pressure.
Wow, that's a great question. It's a really, I mean, as you ask that question, the montage in my mind was like Claudine Gay the death of DEI, right? The demonizing of critical race theory. I mean, it's such a complicated moment. I think on the one hand, Black feminism and its vocabularies and frameworks have developed a cultural visibility that we've never had before. So, I mean, when I started working on intersectionality, I would tell people I worked on intersectionality and they would say, what? And now I tell people I wrote this book on intersectionality and they'll be like, oh, that's so cool, or I know what that is. And that's a really interesting cultural shift, right? And an important cultural shift to mark. Even if what they think intersectionality is not what I think it is, the fact that the term circulates with a greater velocity is really of interest to me. And I think a success of Black feminist intellectual production. So I think all that's really interesting. And I think Black feminism has become uncomfortably institutionalized in ways, right? So, I mean, I think of when I was in college in the olden days as a women's studies major, you know, Black feminism was not treated as a body of thought. There was like a day, you did it for a day, right? And to think about the ways that Black feminism has become visible as a body of thought and as a politics, I think is really transformative. And I think it's a testament to the power that we've accrued that you see the kind of backlash that you see now, right? Including the backlash against Claudine Gay, the backlash against wokeism, right? The perception that Black women are actually running the university and indoctrinating innocent white children with like a radical vocabulary, which clearly Black women are not running the university. It is not an indoctrination camp. But I do think that this kind of right reaction suggests that Black feminism has actually won some kind of major cultural victories, right? Like, I think we really have changed the vocabulary around race and gender and the politics of difference. Like, I will regularly hear people use Moya Bailey's term misogynoir, and not just in the academy. Mm-hmm. I will hear people just say it in the world. And I think like that is a tremendous Black feminist victory.
Yeah.
I love that you brought that around in the end. I thought we were going to end on a somber note, but now I feel uplifted.
Same. And I do recommend folks check out this book as well, because for me as a Black feminist, it also gave me a lot of language, I have to say, from a place of loving critique around what I also have been seeing, which you describe as a Black feminist defensiveness and some originalism going on. And you know, I think you're really the goat at being a loving contrarian in that way. So I did appreciate that as, you know, someone within the movement who has critique of the movement. So we're going to wrap up, Dr. Nash. To end our interview, we ask each of our guests, okay, if there's something they are binging or cringing. So this is your opportunity to drop the rec. You know, it can be totally off brand for you. Okay, does not have to be a serious prestige TV drama about motherhood. It could be, or to give a rant about something cringy in the world today. So the mic is yours.
So nothing generated more anxiety for me than when you mentioned that this would be the closing question.
No pressure.
So I will start by way of confession, which is I don't watch a lot of shows, because what I do watch obsessively is college basketball, particularly women's college basketball. I live in basketball country. I live in Durham, North Carolina. And so we have this great Duke-UNC rivalry that animates much of life. But in the time that I've been here, I went from being a person who watched March Madness to a person who watches college basketball from September through the end of March. Thanks to Dawn Staley, the greatest women's basketball coach of all time, or I'll just say the greatest coach of all time, I have become completely obsessed with women's basketball. I will drive great distances to see amazing women's teams play. So that's what I do. And during the month of March, I largely disconnect from work to stream hours and hours of basketball. So I recommend that your listeners do the same, in part because, you know, here's the tie-in to the topic. I think there's a lot that you can learn about the politics of race and gender from watching women's basketball. And also, it's just fun.
Love it. That's simultaneously the most and least expected answer.
Yeah. I kind of want your own podcast spinoff, because TikTok has introduced me to some of the race and class conflicts between women superstars and how they're perceived, and just sort of ego being admired in some and villainized in others. So for our next episode with you.
Yeah, when you do your March Madness episode, invite me back. I'm happy to come talk sports with you.
Great. Sounds good. Well, anything else that you wanted to mention before we wrap up?
No, thank you both. These were such awesome questions. It was lovely talking to you.
It was so nice to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was our pleasure.
Watch, been getting it poppin'. We cringe watching.
Damn. What a woman. She is so smart. That was our interview with Dr. Jennifer Nash. I hope and can only imagine you agree with us that that was incredible. And now, as we shared, for the absolute climax of this motherhood-themed special episode, we are going to talk to a Cringe Watchers mom herself, the amazing, inimitable Dr. Catherine Fennelly.
Welcome to Cringe Watchers, very special guest, my mom, Kathy Fennelly.
It's so exciting to be on my daughter and Lori's podcast. Thank you for inviting me.
Welcome. We're so excited to have you.
Mom, thank you for joining us. I know that we are sort of shoehorning your book, Family Declassified, into an episode on motherhood, but there are actually more themes of motherhood than one might expect. So you wrote a book about your grandfather, my great-grandfather, who was an incredibly complicated and fascinating character. He was a famous children's book author. He was a spy. He was born in Hungary. He lived in Argentina and Mexico and the U.S. He spoke many languages. But before we dive into the life of a man, I want to focus on the women in the story, starting with your mother, my grandmother, who is our link to this story. And so one of my favorite parts, I swear I read the whole book many times, but I do love the first page the best because you open and dedicate the book to your great-grandmother and to your mother. And you open with an apology to your mother, apologizing for writing a whole book about the father who abandoned her. And so I guess the first question is, in writing this book about your mother's family and uncovering all many things that she concealed and that we didn't know about her or about our family, how did that impact, you know, your relationship with your mother? And why do you think someone who we thought of as so frank and honest and open kept so many things from us?
Well, sadly, my mother died before I began the research for the book. And so it didn't, the research and what I learned did not impact my relationship with my mother. The only thing that I knew that ultimately led me to write the book was that a cousin in California had said, "Kathy, did you know that our family was Jewish?" And I said, "Jewish? No," because my mother in particular was an extremely secular person, very anti-clerical. And she always said, "I'm an atheist. I don't believe in any religion." And when I asked her about that, she protested and said, "No, I'm not Jewish. I'm an atheist," as if that were the extent of the definition. She wouldn't talk about it. And I didn't know why. But at that time, I was becoming a new mother myself, and I was finishing my dissertation. I was pretty busy, as I know you all can understand, and especially you right now, Lori. And so I didn't pursue it. And then later, when I got the results of 23andMe and learned that, in fact, there wasn't just a Jewish uncle in the family tree, that all of my mother's, her parents, her siblings, her cousins, her aunts and her uncles, everyone was Jewish. We were 98.4% Ashkenazi on my mother's side.
Wow.
That really was wow for me, too. And then I got a letter from a researcher in Austria saying he was researching my grandfather's life as a spy. So those were the things that made me say, wait, I've got to figure this out. And I began several years of research. So the relationship with my mother is sadly a posthumous question that I have for her, which is, how could a woman who was defined by her directness and her honesty, how could she have kept this secret my whole life, and my grandmother, because I didn't know my grandfather well. He was living in Mexico when I was young and in Europe before I was born. And I only saw him occasionally. My mother was estranged from him, but my grandmother I knew very well. And so the two most important maternal figures in my life were keeping a secret from me that turned out to be quite significant, because not only is our family Jewish, but we have relatives who were murdered in the Hungarian Holocaust.
Wow. And thank you for sharing that. May I call you Kathy?
Please do. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that, Kathy. And, you know, you referenced my status. I'm very pregnant as we sit here together. And it's really fascinating what you're sharing. And while the family that you write about in the book
maybe takes it to a bit more of an extreme than many families. I don't think it's a totally unique dynamic, right, to have a family secret, and especially for a mother to keep certain parts of herself secret or hidden, ostensibly to protect her family and to protect especially her children. And it makes me think about what parts of myself or ourself that we want to keep close, or the identities we feel we might shelf as we become mothers. So I really appreciate you laying this all out there and applying your research background to tell this story, which is both exceptional and I think very relatable. So I'm curious, you know, for you, the other mother in the dedication that Layla referenced, being your great-grandmother, Rosa, I'm curious if you want to share with our audience a little bit more about her story, which is kind of even further removed than your own mother's story from you, and what it felt like to uncover some of the secrets from her life, including the fact that she'd been institutionalized.
Very sad is the short response to how it felt. What I learned was that first, when I first looked at my grandfather's declassified files from the Organization of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA, which is where he worked and became a spy. When I looked at those, he had listed someone else as his mother. And what I learned was that when my grandfather was 1 year old, his mother was institutionalized. She was put into what they called an insane asylum. A lunatic asylum is what they actually called it. She was there for 25 years. So there are all kinds of issues about motherhood and women wrapped up in that. One is that it was at that time in the Austro-Hungarian Empire and in the United States as well. I think it was very easy for men, for husbands, for family members to force someone to be institutionalized. Now, I corresponded with an expert on psychiatric hospitals in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and she said to me that if my great-grandmother was institutionalized for 25 years, it was not likely to have been a short-term issue. She may have been schizophrenic. And the really tragic thing is that she was erased from the family history. And secondly, after she was released, when she was a relatively old woman, she lived in Budapest with her oldest daughter. And then her daughter was murdered by the Hungarian fascists. And my great-grandmother died 1 month later of heart failure. And her nephew, her grandson was shot to death in a labor camp, forced labor camp. So the tragedy of this woman, you know, I'm a fairly recent grandmother, 3.5 years ago. My first grandchild was born, another one 11 months ago. And I know that my grandchildren won't know me personally when they're adults. But to think that no one would speak my name, that I would be erased, that can make me cry right now.
Yeah, I'm surprised. And I knew that reading your book, I would feel connected to our family. But it is a family I feel fairly distant from. And I, all of the parts about Rosa, your great-grandmother, I felt deeply personal, and felt the injustice of her life, because it was just clearly she was locked away and forgotten. I have to say, one of the things that I thought about before, but I've thought about so much since you wrote this book, is I think it occurred to me once in college, my mother is as Hungarian as I am Iranian. And anybody who knows me or who's listened to this podcast, like being half Iranian is like my whole identity. It's a huge part of my life. And part of that is because even though I'm only half my American mother, you lived in Iran, speak Farsi. I grew up in an Iranian community. My father immigrated as an adult. Your mother came to this country as a little girl. But this book, for me, really made me want to investigate our Hungarian side, this other secret side, and also opened up for me this sort of patch of history that wasn't very clear to me, which is how much the Holocaust and World War II affected Hungarians and how different it was from sort of the blockbuster films I've seen depicting Jews and internment during World War II. So do you feel more culturally connected to Hungary now?
You know, I would say I feel more culturally distanced from Hungary because I have found, I've talked to and read quite a bit of work about the Hungarian Holocaust, and I've spoken to experts. This is not my original field, as you know. My field is demography and public health and so on. But I've learned quite a bit. And what I found is that even experts often don't know the extent or the brutality of the Holocaust in Hungary. I think easily it could be called the most brutal application of the plan to exterminate Jews in all of Europe in World War II. It was unbelievably brutal. And it was picked up by Hungarians. When the Germans were leaving Hungary, it was Hungarian Christians who carried out the murder at the very end of the war, when Hitler had just about been defeated. And 75% of the Jews in Hungary were killed within 12 months from the time that Hitler invaded Hungary in March of 1944, at the very end of the war, to 12 months later, after, you know, after he had died. And so when I grew up, I heard the kinds of stories that one hears, the lyrical stories about the music, the chardash, and the food. You know, my grandmother and my mother were great cooks. My grandfather was a great cook. And we'd go to stores in Little Hungary or Germantown in Manhattan. But I never, ever knew about the Christian nationalism. And it's especially difficult to read about now because it's being repeated by Orban in Hungary, who has elevated Christian nationalism again to the detriment of non-Christians. It's a very frightening time.
Yeah.
That is really, really upsetting to hear about that history. And I almost have the same question, but about Jewishness as a Jew of color, you know, here who has, you know, balanced multiple cultural backgrounds my whole life. I'm curious if you have explored or plan to explore more of that side of things after discovering that the 98% Ashkenazi is pretty definitive.
Yes and no. I'm still a very secular person. I got that especially from my mother, I think, and not someone who goes to religious services. But for example, yesterday morning, I spent the morning mailing copies of my book to liberal and reform synagogue congregations in the New York area. And before I did that, I would go to each one and read about the rabbi and the assistant rabbi and the cantor and so on. And several of them, I thought, wow, this sounds like such a cool place. It's the values of many of those congregations with which I identify and have actually. I have very close Jewish friends and always have.
And you are deeply involved in Beth Elohim and in here in Brooklyn.
Yes, because of I was deeply involved with the Immigrant Refugee Task Force, and I still am with an offshoot which is called Ruth's Refuge, which is a nonprofit that helps immigrants. And I very much am in sync with the values that welcome the stranger, that want to work with immigrants and refugees of all religions and denominations, Muslim and queer people and so forth, which is what we do. So I'm attracted to that side of liberal and reform Judaism, but not to the religious side.
It's super fascinating to think about how the values of a liberal Jewish lineage might have survived, even if the named identity did not. So thank you for sharing that. And it, again, you know, to bring us back to our theme, it makes me think about parenting and how we, you know, share what we can with our community and with our family. So I would love to switch gears, if that's okay.
Sure.
To talk a little bit more about the parenting of it all. And obviously you're the first coast mother we've had on our show formally. So thank you for agreeing to that. And, you know, I think, you know, Layla and I are both in a period of transition in terms of our relationship to the idea of motherhood, a lot of ambivalence that we've explored together over the years around that. One thing I've noticed is since becoming pregnant, I've received an enormous amount of unsolicited attention, advice, energy, in many different ways. So, you know, I think we're both eager to just hear from you. Any advice you have for navigating
you know, social expectations for mothers or non-mothers alike. How do we approach the world as people try to project things onto us, whether we're pregnant, mothers choosing not to be mothers, or unable to become mothers? What should we be holding on to and thinking about to protect ourselves and keep ourselves steady? What's your motherly advice?
Well, I think both of you are role models, actually, for, you know, how you talk about motherhood and feminism. And so I wouldn't deign to give you advice on that. As far as being a mother, I've always believed in treating even small children as creatures who can understand emotions, who can understand moral values, and not as subjects whom we teach to be moral or ethical individuals. I feel strongly about that. And I love seeing that in children, the ways in which they try to work out ethical issues or relationships with parents and peers and so forth. So I guess the one piece of advice that I would give is to do that, not to walk into parenthood thinking, I need to figure out how to mold this child to be a successful young person and adult, because I think, in fact, they will accomplish that. If you know, I have a silly analogy that I use sometimes, which is that it's like that game of curling where there are pucks on the ice and the goal of the people playing is just to sweep in front of the object, the curl, if that's what it's called, the puck. And to make the path smooth so that it will reach its end objective. And I actually think that's a really good analogy for parenting. What you need to do is be sure that the path is clear and sweep away any impediments. And then the child, in fact, will head in the right direction most of the time.
Is that what you did with us?
I feel like you have to tell me that.
No, I feel like I put more obstacles in your way than you cleared from mine.
No.
I benefit from your curling efforts in enjoying the fruits of your labor and, you know, joining Layla as a co-host for this podcast all the time. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to hear because now I see you so often with my niece who's 3 and a half going on 16. And the way you interact with her is the way you're describing that I think a lot of people aspire to, but it's so easy to talk down to little children, but you never do. You're always talking to Clara. And I think you always spoke to us. And I think the reason Soraya and I are very chatty and have pursued careers in related to communications, the reason your granddaughters are so chatty is, and we all enunciate very clearly and we all have very correct grammar, is that influence from you and maybe a legacy of grandma.
Yes, I think so.
She also always took us very seriously as little adults.
That's right.
I have another personal question because we're about to have something else in common, which is having had hysterectomies. By the time this podcast goes out, I will have had the procedure. And the reason I'm doing that, I'm sure we'll have talked about this in the intro, but I discovered I had the BRCA2 genetic mutation because you had ovarian cancer and had a hysterectomy. It's what made me seek it out. And actually, I originally thought it might be our hidden Ashkenazi heritage that had given me this legacy, but turns out it wasn't. Don't have that strain. But I'm wondering, you know, we're at different ages, but we were both done with our family planning decisions by the time this came around. If you don't mind getting personal, was it emotional? How did you feel about having a hysterectomy? Did you have any connection to your identity as a woman? And do you have advice for me?
You know, years ago, actually my first real job, I worked for a pathologist at Columbia Presbyterian for about a year. And he used to call the uterus a vestigial organ in postmenopausal women and believe that it should be taken out because it's a site for disease. I don't subscribe to that, but I didn't have an emotional attachment. I was postmenopausal and it happened quite quickly too. It was sort of an accidental discovery that I had ovarian cancer, and there was no question in my mind that I wanted to do whatever was necessary to get rid of it. So, and I have been very impressed with modern medicine, modern surgery, and how, for me, how simple the procedure was and the recovery was very quick. So the answer is no, I didn't have an emotional connection at that stage of my life to the uterus or to, you know, opposition to hysterectomy.
Well, I aspire to bounce back as quickly as you did.
Oh, I hope so. I think you will.
Well, can I ask a follow-up question based on that? You know, Kathy, what is it like helping your child navigate this same experience? You know, have any feelings come up in this process as you watch Layla navigate this in similar but also different circumstances?
Well, I feel pride at how she's able to face what is in fact a very difficult and scary situation and just move ahead and take steps to do what she needs to do. And I hope she's gotten that from me, because I tend to be very pragmatic and practical about these things, but it's very hard to see your child have to face any health challenge. And so it's difficult.
Well, I definitely think I got that from you. The other thing I got from you was always check maximum coverage when you're making your health insurance decisions.
Oh,
it's worth
really?
The extra money. It'll come in later.
Yeah, really.
Now we're getting the good advice.
Don't subscribe to a plan that makes you go to only one set of providers in one locality, because if you need specialists, you need that flexibility. And I think it's worth paying more for your plan to have that.
Well, that's definitely been true.
This is true mom advice. Yeah, this is good stuff. Wow.
And also, I mean, this is something that the two of you know backwards and forwards, but going to the right sources of information is becoming more difficult and is so important. I subscribe to something called the Merck Manual, which is a wonderful resource that physicians use to look up the characteristics of diseases. And there's an iPhone version. I recommend it to people. You can look up all sorts of, and places like the Mayo Clinic and the really serious medical sites are the ones to look at, not the others.
I recommend having a mother who pays for the subscription, because I texted her yesterday and said there was an irregularity in my EKG pre-op and now I have to go get cleared by a cardiologist and here's what I have. And she texted back and said, well, Merck's manual agrees that it probably won't delay your surgery.
Your public health background is definitely showing here, as it does regularly when I have worked with Layla in many different professional contexts. But I wonder if we want to wrap up by touching on that background a bit, because it does kind of flow through, I think, a number of the book and your relationship to Layla, and even previous episodes we've done. So Layla, I wonder if we have time to do kind of one thing about that.
It's interesting, Mom, because obviously outing myself as a Nepo baby of sorts, I have pursued reproductive health, which was your original career. I know people who know you think of you as an immigration and public policy expert now, but one of the things I most admire about you is how many pivots you've made and how you've modeled that you're not stuck with one career once you pick it. But when I was growing up, you were part of the original wave of people redefining population health as family health. And I think that continues to evolve today. Lori and I have a lot of conversations about whether or not we work in family planning or actually sexual health or feminism and other fields. But I'm wondering, because you were there from the 70s on and at Columbia, where the paper Where is the Mother in Mother and Child Health was first emerged, if you have thoughts about how far we've come or if we've evolved, because I mean, I think your career has been in parallel to our switch from population control and telling women to have fewer children, and from the public health focus on the life and vitality of the infants, to more thinking about women as more than our uteri. How do you think the field has evolved, and where do we need to still go?
Well, I want to credit Deborah Main and Alan Rosenfield for that Where's the M in MCH, an important paper that got discussion going many years ago. And in the beginning, I think I was naive about some aspects of reproductive health family planning. I've since come to recognize much more of the population control side of zero population growth and even the intersection between things like the eugenics movement and early family planning reproductive health. So I have learned to distance myself, of course, from those trends or threads. But I've always felt strongly that women should have the right to control our bodies and that we need to receive education, broad education about sexuality, about reproductive health, about the pros and the cons of early childbearing. And I think that sadly is still not nearly shared enough. And there are certainly, as you all know, is terrible opposition to even saying the word sex to young people. And that worries me greatly, that trend. So on the other hand, you know, the word feminism is much more broadly accepted and used. And some of the ideas of women's rights and the fact that we have the right to control our bodies is more broadly accepted than it was when I was early in the field. And yet we still don't have an equal rights amendment, you know, saying that women should not be discriminated against on the basis of sex or of gender. Pretty basic, and yet it can't get passed.
Yeah, it remains controversial.
The exact wording came to my mind, that equal rights under the law shall not be abridged because of gender.
I think that it's so interesting to hear your reflections as someone who, you know, really witnessed this seismic shift in the sector. And it just makes me think about how feminism is another thing that can and does get passed on, you know, through generations. You know, there's many ways to catch it. But I think from a mother is a really, in many ways, ideal way. And it's pretty cool that Layla, your mom gave you that background. I wouldn't go so far to call you a Nepo baby, though. I don't know.
No, I'm kidding. I mean, it's not a very profitable legacy, but it is intellectually profitable.
Satisfying.
There you go. Awesome.
Definitely.
I'm curious to get to the binge. Yeah.
Do you want to ask?
Well, sure. Kathy, is there anything you're binging right now?
You know, because of the ongoing work that I've been doing for my book, which is called Family Declassified, I've been binging on something called History Hub, which is the National Archives has a crowdsourced database where citizen archivists and actual paid archivists at the National Archives provide free advice on all kinds of questions. And it's so cool. So if you go to History Hub, you can post a question. It could be about your family. You could say, well, I have a grandmother whose name was, you know, Maria Tolstoy, and she was born in 1832, and I'm trying to find out, you know, when she arrived in the United States and what her, and citizen archivists or National Archives archivists will answer that question and say, well, here's an immigration record that you should look at, and here's a ship manifest that has her name in it, or it could be all sorts of other historical questions. So I love that. And another source, a similar source, but a little bit more focused, is Jewish Gen. Jewish Gen has a newsletter to which I subscribe. And every day I look at just all kinds of questions and responses from other people who are interested in this case, Jewish genealogy or genealogy in general. So for people who share those interests in history and genealogy, I recommend those too.
Amazing. Those are great recs. I think that there are some history nerds who listen to Cringe Watchers who are going to dive into that. Well, thank you, Mom, for agreeing to be interviewed and for taking twice as long to set up the tech as the interview itself. We appreciate all the time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
That was very impressive, and I don't know that I would have been able to guide my mom virtually to do it. So I think we should be proud of what we've accomplished here today. And I really appreciate you coming on and being our first mom guest for our motherhood episode. So nice
Thank
to talk
you.
With you.
Very nice to talk to you. It makes me want to say, let's get coffee and keep talking.
Yeah, we should. Would love that.
Yes. Thank you to our guests, Dr. Nash and Dr. Catherine Fennelly, a.k.a. Mom. You can find Dr. Nash on Twitter at PornoScholar, and you can find my mom's work at katherinefennelly.com. That's K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E-F-E-N-N-E-L-L-Y.com. and buy their books, Birthing Black Mothers and Family Declassified.
Yes, buy their books. You will not regret it. Our editor today is Rue Spence. D.L. Dallas Engram created our theme song. Judith Walker created our logos and cover art. You can support the show by visiting patreon.com/cringewatchers. Subscribe today and get cool perks like a shout out on the show. And we also appreciate you supporting our family and medical leaves through the spring.
You can also support the show by rating and reviewing it and following us on Instagram @cringewatchers. Thank you for cringe watching, and see you in the spring.